So your work is looking at linking genetic variations to susceptibility of common diseases like diabetes, cardiovascular disease. We've known about the hereditability of these kinds of diseases for about over 100 years. So why is it only that we're making significant progress now when previous work on the genetic basis of common diseases has not been overly successful?
For over a century, people have recognized that traits run in families. So if you look at your kids, they tend to look like you. And in fact, the first such trait that was studied was height. A guy named Galton, who was actually related to Charles Darwin, figured out that tall parents tend to have tall children and short parents tend to have short children. And it was also understood very early on that there are some diseases and traits that are caused by a single gene. So diseases like muscular dystrophy and Huntington's disease and early onset breast cancer, for example, are diseases where there's one gene, and if you inherit a mutation in it, you'll get that disease most of the time. Cystic fibrosis, another famous example. But most diseases, heart attack, diabetes, cancer, these diseases do have a genetic component that was recognized early on because the relatives of people who have the disease are more likely to have the disease than the random person in the population. But most diseases aren't caused by one gene. Most diseases are caused by a combination of many genes and the environment and behavior and chance. It's what we call complex inheritance. And in the case where each gene contributes only a little bit along with these other factors, it's a much harder problem. In the last few years, we see tremendous progress all of a sudden on these common diseases that had proven very difficult. And if we ask why are we seeing progress now, it's a combination of things, but probably the single event was the sequencing of the human genome and the set of tools and methods that came from that. So the task of finding the gene that causes a disease can be thought of a little bit like trying to find a criminal who committed a crime. And just as there are many, many people in America who could have committed the crime, there are many places in the genome, many potential genetic variants that could be the culprit. The early days of this kind of work, it was kind of like trying to find a criminal in 1800, before we really knew the map of America. What the Human Genome Project gave us was Google Maps of America. Right. That doesn't mean you know which part of the country has your culprit, or in the case of the genome, which part of the genome contains your disease gene. But boy, it's a lot easier if you know everything in terms of where to look.
Going back to that, how many genes are we talking here? Are we talking like a handful, hundreds?
Sure. So we know that the number of genes that affect any given disease varies from one, could be if it was cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease, all the way to all of them. We know there are 20,000 or so human genes. We know that it's not one gene that causes diabetes. We know that because if it was one gene, it would have been found a long time ago. But also because in the last 2 years, 20 different genes that influence type 2 diabetes have been found. 30-some genes that influence cholesterol are known. 30 genes that affect Crohn's disease have been found all in the last couple of years. So that tells us there are at least dozens, because we're already finding dozens, but whether it's hundreds or dozens or even more, we don't know.
But in terms of influence, what's the range?
So genetic influences on disease can range from having a very, very big effect, like if you inherit this mutation in the cystic fibrosis gene, your risk goes up 1,000-fold and essentially you will get that disease, to a very small effect, where if you inherit this altered version of a gene, your risk of a disease is 10% higher. And it's possible, in fact, even likely, that there are gene variants that influence risk by 1% or 2%. This, of course, is familiar to patients who have gone to the doctor and had their cholesterol measured or their blood pressure measured. Because, in fact, there are some people whose cholesterol is extremely high. You could think of that as having a very severe mutation, as analogous to having a very severe mutation in a gene. And then their risk of heart attack is much elevated. There are people whose cholesterol is only 10 or 20 points higher than someone else, and their risk of having a heart attack is only very modestly increased. Mm. Genetics is kind of like that. The key thing, and I think the way to think about the genetic research that's being done, is we need to understand what's the underlying biology of the disease. That's really, in my view, the goal of all this work. This method of studying the inheritance of the disease is a way in.
So this work is looking at the pathophysiology of diseases, and it's helping us understand the genetic basis and how it sort of progresses and everything. Is it useful as a diagnostic tool in the lab?
To translate these new clues about disease into better understanding and better prevention and better treatment, that's going to take a long time. It's going to take a long time because there are many genes and we're only beginning to understand them. There's a lot more work to just find them all.
When is this, I'm just backtracking a little bit, when did it all start, the whole finding all these small regions?
Let me give you a quick timeline of progress in genetics. It was 100 years ago that it was recognized all these diseases are inherited. In the early 1980s, a set of methods were developed to find those single gene causes of rare inherited diseases, and all of a sudden it became possible to discover them. In fact, Jim Gusella at Mass General and Harvard Medical School mapped the Huntington's disease gene in 1983, and that was the first discovery of this new approach. And within 20 years, 2,000 human disease genes for rare inherited conditions were found. But progress in the common diseases really was very, very slow, almost non-existent. In 2005 or so, following the sequencing of the human genome and a set of projects called the HapMap Project and others to study the variation in the human genome, it became possible to start looking systematically at common genetic variants for their contributions to disease. And going into 2005, there were perhaps 20 known common genetic variants that influenced any disease. So not 20 for heart attack, but 20 for all of medicine. In 2007 alone, 180 such discoveries were made. And I think that for the next 5 years, we're going to see continued tremendous progress, simply because now that we have a method that in its first iteration works, and it's important to realize this isn't the end of this kind of genetics, it's the first couple of years of it working, I think we're going to see progress that's similar to what happened with human single gene disorders, where the first mappings were done in 1980, and over about 10 or 20 years, the major genetic risk factors were found. And assuming the rate of progress is at all similar to what we've been seeing, and given that technology continues to race ahead to look in an ever more detailed way at the relationship between genetics and disease, I think we will see tremendous progress in the coming years identifying genetic risk factors. One of the questions is, it's all well and good to understand biology and hope in the future for new treatments. What can we do today? Can we do diagnostic or predictive testing? It's important to put this in context because most people are familiar with genetic testing in the setting of rare diseases where the gene variant is highly predictive. So you're unlikely to have a positive result because the mutation is very rare in the population, but if you're unlucky enough to inherit it, then it's highly predictive. The new genetic variants that have been found in the last 2 years are almost the inverse of that. They're common, so you're highly likely, in fact almost guaranteed, to carry some of them, and their individual effects are modest.
It's true that also that some increase your risk and some actually reduce your risk.
That's right. So you have to think of these more like cholesterol. Some people have high cholesterol, some people have low cholesterol. It can either be a risk factor or protective. So in the last year or so, we've actually seen not just scientific papers describing the early days of asking, can we predict risk for patients based on these genetic risk factors, but also companies springing up that are selling direct to the consumer genetic information. They will, for a fee, test your genome for these genetic variations and give you back a risk report. So one of the things that everyone has to ask themselves is, if they're interested at all, is this useful? Is it useful today? Will it be useful in the future? I think it's absolutely clear that in the future this will be useful.
Right.
And the setting in which it will be useful is the setting in which a person faces a choice about either a change in their lifestyle or how they live, about a drug or a treatment they could take to prevent a disease, and a better estimate of their individual risk would make a difference to them.
Right.
We published a paper in the New England Journal a couple of months ago about risk prediction in heart attack, which is, I think, a very important example of where genetics could, in principle at least, help. This is because heart attack is the number one cause of death in the industrialized world. We have very good preventative treatments for heart attack. and not everybody takes them. So this is the setup in which a better estimate of risk can be helpful. You have effective treatments to prevent. They have side effects, so you don't want to give them to everyone, yeah. and you have to decide who should take them. And the paper we published in New England Journal was looking at whether or not these first wave of new findings about genes for cholesterol could add any information to just simply measuring your blood cholesterol.
Yeah.
So, of course, you can just do that. Mm. And the paper was encouraging in that it showed that even having already had your cholesterol checked, knowing the genetics plus the cholesterol gave you a better risk prediction than just the cholesterol alone. And since there are national guidelines that say if your risk is above X, you should have a treatment, and below Y, you shouldn't, this might be useful. The key is we need research. The ability to make a good decision as an individual for yourself requires good information about if I do X, what's likely to happen, or if I do Y, what's likely to happen. What I'd like to see is a lot of research that says, here's the standard way someone lives their life, or here's the standard way doctors give advice to patients, and here are some genetic tests that have been brought into the mix, and ask the question, do the people who have access to that genetic information do better than the ones who don't? And if the answer is yes, then we'll really have done something useful. But until we know that answer is yes, I guess it seems to me hubris on the part of the geneticists and the biotech companies who are selling this to claim that simply because we give information, we're doing benefit. We have to do better than that as a research community. We have to demonstrate benefit, not just hope for benefit.
Right. I guess in the future, you could see this as a test that you do, like you test someone's blood pressure. Is this something that you envisage in the future, or is that, you know, pie in the sky?
I think that that will happen. And I think that it will be a good thing on the day that we have enough information to really give valuable, accurate, predictive information to patients. And that day is not that far off. I'm not saying it's decades off. But we need good information. Mm-hmm. I think that the one thing that is the same, I personally believe, about genetics as cholesterol or anything else is that for most people, it will be not deterministic, but it will be risk factors.
Right.
And the genetics community actually has a bit of a hard time with that, because the genetics community grew up around these single gene disorders where genes are highly predictive, and geneticists often find that troubling, that these risk factors are just risk factors. But as I'm trained as a physician, as a diabetes and internal medicine doctor, and my patients actually all had to deal with risk factors because we couldn't tell them whether they were going to have kidney damage from their diabetes or not. It was a risk factor. We couldn't tell them if they would have a heart attack or not.
Yeah.
We could tell them they had high cholesterol.
But in terms of risk factors, how much influence do the risk factors have?
We have to make a distinction between what we know today and what we might know in the future.
Right.
What we know today is genetic risk factors that are either rare and have a big effect, or common and in aggregate might explain two or threefold differences in risk. And that's actually that's only a fraction, I should say, of all of genetics. We know that, for example, the risk to someone of having type 2 diabetes in America today is about 8%. The risk to a sibling of someone who has the disease is 30%.
Right.
And the risk to someone who's the identical twin of someone who has the disease is upwards of 80%. That suggests that at the end of the day, when we know all the genetic risk factors for diabetes, we might be able to put people into categories with much bigger differences in risk because we've only just begun to identify these genes and to understand how they work. But having said that, I think that cholesterol is useful to people, blood pressure is useful, because following the understanding that blood pressure was a risk factor, there were drugs developed to lower blood pressure. And the same thing with cholesterol. Once it was figured out that LDL cholesterol in particular was related to heart attack and stroke, drugs were developed to lower it.
Right.
And I think society's attitude towards blood pressure and cholesterol would be very different if we didn't have those pills. If all you did when you went to the doctor was you were told, well, you've got high cholesterol and you're at risk, or you've got low cholesterol and you're not, I think people wouldn't actually be that interested. I think they're interested because we can do something about it. And I think that the interest in the public about genetics will and should be entirely around what changes can you make that actually benefit you.
So basically you're saying that there is, you're hoping that one day we'd be able to find some way of actually treating the changes that occur due to these genetic mutations or changes in the genome.
And not only that, I think that is clearly our vision, and that's clearly why we're in this business, is the idea that in order to offer better treatments and prevention to patients, we need to know what's going wrong,
yeah.
and that genetics is a good way to figure that out. But more than that, it's important people realize that that doesn't mean some high-tech gene therapy. It doesn't necessarily mean that the intervention will be genetic. The best example of this is a disease called phenylketonuria. It's not a new discovery. It's actually a very old genetic insight. There are children who were born with mental retardation, and it ran in families, and it was figured out many decades ago that in a small fraction of such kids, but not insignificant, mm. it's because they can't digest this amino acid called phenylalanine. Okay. And the disease, which is called phenylketonuria, results in a toxic buildup of a chemical early in life and causes brain damage and mental, what appears to be mental retardation. This insight led to the idea that maybe if you could take phenylalanine out of the diet, then the babies could avoid mental retardation. Yeah. Remarkably enough, this is true. But if you know who these children are, you can have their families feed them diets without phenylalanine, and then they will grow up with normal IQs. So this actually is a remarkable success. And note that that doesn't take fancy genetic interventions. It's not gene therapy. It's just understanding the disease and then being able to do something to prevent the bad outcome from happening. That's my own vision and that of my colleagues of what we're trying to do here. Then no one will think of it as genetics. They'll just think of it as medicine, which yeah. is what I think the future should be, is just how we, not a brave new world, but just a world with better medicine and better prevention, better public health, where the genetics will play a role by mm. pointing to where we should focus.
That's really, really exciting.
I agree.
No, that's brilliant. Thank you very much for talking to me today, and I wish you all the luck.